From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Since the time when our ancestors began scribbling on cave walls, conflict has been part of the human condition. Earliest records tell of violence and war, and much of history is dominated by bloodshed and struggle against oppression. So, is peace, lasting peace, possible? A growing number of academics think so, and there's an uptick in interest on Utah college campuses to study peace. Today on the program, we're exploring just what peace studies is and the role conflict resolution can play in relationships of all kinds, from marriages to business to global politics. Plus, a clean, well-insulated place. The 125 house and architectural experiment is done, and we'll find out about the results. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Give peace a chance. That's the message a growing number of college students and faculty have for the Utah State Board of Regents as they contemplate new majors in peace studies and peace justice at the University of Utah and Utah Valley University. But what exactly does a peace studies program look like? And why is it relevant in our world and marketplace today? Today on the program, we're talking about peace, teaching peace, and incorporating peace into diverse environments. Joining me this hour is Leonard Hawes. He is director of the Peace and Conflict Studies Program at the University of Utah and a professor of communication at the U. And Dr. Hawes, thanks so much for your time today.
You're welcome.
Also with us, Robert Newman, a professor of English and the dean of the College of Humanities at the University of Utah. He started the Peace and Conflict Studies program at the U about 5 years ago. And Professor Newman, thanks to you.
Thank you.
And Michael Minch, director of Peace and Justice Studies at Utah Valley University. He's also an associate professor of philosophy there. And Dr. Minch, thanks for your time.
Good to be here.
Later on in the program, making green building affordable, we follow up on the 125 house, but first, peace. Have you taken a class in conflict resolution or diplomacy? How are you using what you learned in the workplace or in other relationships? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. I want to start with the philosophical basis for a peace studies program. You know, peace is a long tradition in philosophical circles. The philosopher Immanuel Kant says there is a moral imperative to work for peace, but why study peace as an academic discipline? Let's start with you, Professor Hawes.
Yes. One of the things that our program is trying to provide is a structure and a context for our students to understand conflict and the work of the peace process. It's important for our students to understand that peace isn't some static condition that will arrive at some point in time, but that involves the hard work day in and day out of creating peaceful conditions. Everything from family conditions to international relations. And the point, of course, is to create a more civil, a more productive, a more humane world, every place from families and personal relationships to international relations. And an academic study, particularly in the humanities and in that tradition, and it's important to emphasize that our program is interdisciplinary, so it involves some 24 departments and 45 faculty members, and a range of courses, about 125 of them, that range across three colleges and certainly a variety of interest areas. And the reason for that is to give our students a broad perspective that they can take and out of the university and apply to their majors and their career plans, because in all of those, certainly now, managing conflict, managing complex circumstances without having conflict derail productive relations is crucial. in everything from engineering and the sciences and medicine to domestic relations to international relations. Mm.
Dean Newman, as I mentioned, you started the Peace and Conflict Studies program at the U about 5 years ago. What got you thinking that this discipline needed a formal place on campus?
Well, it really arose after we had started our Environmental Humanities Master's program in my mind, where I saw that environmental degradation throughout the world had also produced instances of war and poverty and human diasporas. And really, the more I was thinking about our interdisciplinary and international programs, I saw that really complex global issues need interdisciplinary answers. And we had to increasingly do programs that translate theory into practice. And I was also increasingly disturbed and interested in the need to build or rebuild a civil society in our country. Hmm. So the Peace and Conflict Studies program came out of all that that array of thinking and is addressing all of those needs.
Hmm. Dr. Minch, I understand at Utah Valley University, your peace and justice program has been underway or gaining steam since 9/11. Talk about the genesis of your program and how it has changed over the years since 9/11 and how you're thinking about it now.
Well, when it appeared to many of us on campus that the United States was going to be involved in a war in Iraq in particular, we decided to respond in an intellectual and academic way by creating a number of learning opportunities for students. So we had a number of lectures and films and discussions and so on about Iraq and the United States and the history of those two countries and the meaning of war and the meaning of peace and the meaning of terrorism and so on. And we had such a very positive response to that series of academic events that we decided to put a formal program together, and thus was born slowly over a period of time because we wanted to be very careful and very inclusive, very strategic. And so we built a Peace and Justice Studies program that created a minor and is now on its way to a major and has grown rapidly and excitedly. And so it's been great.
Hmm. Dr. Hawes, while peace studies may be somewhat new to Utah, it certainly has a presence on college campuses nationally. It has a rich history, kind of gaining traction on the university campuses after World War II. Can you give us a sketch of just how peace studies has been perceived and built since the mid 20th century?
Yes. There are approximately 120-some programs in universities ranging from top-tier Research One universities, Berkeley, to state universities, to smaller private liberal arts colleges, to religious small colleges, Mennonite University and so on. And even in smaller two-year programs, which students earn associate degrees. And they have been in place in one form or another. A few between World War I and World War II, but really the growth was from the late 40s, mid to late 40s, through the 60s. And then, of course, the 60s changed the shape of some of those programs, and they've been growing since. The focus has been on everything from dialogue and diversity emphases to global justice issues to global security, human rights emphases, social activism, religious interventions and religious dialogue programs, because so much of the conflict, certainly now as then, is ideological/religious in nature. and clearly armed conflict does nothing but exacerbate that. And yet my focus and the focus of our program, it's communication and communication practices in nature, because that's bottom line, the work when people come together of creating new possibilities, additional possibilities, new frames for old conditions. And there are a variety of ways, conversations, negotiations, mediations, dialogue formats that allow our students and anyone participating in the programs to learn a variety of new skills. And I'd say that that's one of the things that sets our program at the university apart, is where it's located, not just in the humanities, but that it has at its core communication and communication practices focus.
Dr. Leonard Haas is director of the Peace and Conflict Studies Program at the University of Utah. Also with us, Dr. Michael Minch, director of Peace and Justice Studies at Utah Valley University, and Robert Newman, dean of the College of Humanities at the University of Utah. If you'd like to join us, we're talking about peace studies and what we can learn about peace on campuses and translate that to other organizations. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Dean Newman, I want to turn to some of the basics of peace studies. What do we know about the causes of conflict? Dr. Haas, you pointed out a couple of those, but can you sketch out some of the real hardcore causes why we can't get along?
Well, I think they're multifaceted. Certainly, lack of dialogue, lack of communication, lack of conversation, lack of broad context, and hence we are moving in this program from an interdisciplinary perspective. Often we speak out of silos, and we have difficulties negotiating those silos. So one of the tracks in this program will be, for example, an environmental conflict resolution track, where we want to enhance the type of discussion and dialogue that is now going on in the environmental movement, so that we can have, for example, environmental activists able to talk to oil companies, able to talk to ranchers, so that we can mediate those discussions much more effectively than having them consistently talk in sound bites and across purposes.
Sounds to me like there's a real practical part of the program that you are hoping to create, that it's not just theory and studying philosophy, although that's important to understand these underlying causes, but to give some tools on how to actually put this into practice.
Absolutely. I very much believe that 21st century university education, to make significant impact on some of the major world issues, which is what universities should be doing, requires the translation of theory into practice and requires that we teach our students to apply their classroom activity to the real world.
And Dr. Minch, that seems to be a foundational value for your program as well.
Yeah, it's a very important part of what we do. We have students doing internships with the United Nations and other multilateral agencies in Santiago, Geneva, Uganda, Jordan, other places around the world. We take students to Northern Ireland, to Haiti. We'll be taking them to Russia, take them to the Middle East, to Cuba. And like Robert said, it's important for our students and for our listeners to know that, you know, peace building is a discipline. It's a craft. There's a science. There's a set of methodologies, there's a literature, and just as all other university students prepare for professions and careers where they learn to change the world and hopefully make it better, so too with those students who graduate from peace studies programs. So it's important to us. So I wanted to add one other thing to answer your question that you asked, Robert, and that is in terms of why people use violence against one another. They have interests. We all have interests. We all are interested in giving our children hope, in having a decent opportunity in life for food and security and economic sustainability and so on. And when people feel like their interests are not able to be attained peacefully, they turn to violence. So in our program, that's why we've chosen to use the word justice, because justice prevents violence, and people act violently when they believe they've been dealt with unjustly. There's that connection, and I want to add that as well.
Are the classes within your programs overtly political? I mean, I sense that there is something of an activist strain, and I guess, I mean, in some circles, pacifism has become a dirty word. So what's the relationship between pacifism and peace building, if there is one, and how do you approach that in a classroom setting? Dr. Midge.
Well, you've asked two questions, so briefly. Our faculty, our programs, our curriculum offerings aren't narrowly political. They're not activist-oriented. They're political in that you're talking to a political theorist. So, yes, in some sense, you know, they're political because, as Leonard said, you know, we're talking about ideologies. We're talking about political economy. We're talking about where people are coming from and the institutions they build. And that's all about politics, of course, but not political in any narrow sense, to be sure, and not activist in any narrow sense, to be sure, either. But obviously, as Robert has said, we're training students to be fully equipped and educated to make a difference in the world, and that is to say, to be active. But our programs are rigorously academic, and so there's a kind of intellectual training that takes place in our programs, as in all other programs. But then we want our students to enter the world in their professions and, of course, be actively engaged in applying their skills to make the world better in any number of peace-building ways.
Dr. Haas? Oh, I'm sorry, Dean Newman?
Well, I would just follow up on that, first of all, by endorsing everything Michael has said, but also to add that I think what we hope that our students will emerge from these programs with is a broadened sense of civic and ethical responsibility. And that requires that they not approach subjects from only one dimension, and only one perspective, or only one ideology. So we try to give them broad context. We try to give them the multiple perspectives and the different points of views with which they need to juggle.
And I'd add to that it's activist to respond to what Michael was saying a bit, not in a narrowly political sense, but in a becoming engaged sense. In the students caring enough and knowing enough about what's going on in their private and global world, and to have the skills and the hope that comes with having skills, to become engaged and to have a sense that they can make a difference. And there are a variety of those skills, economic skills, philosophical skills, communication skills. I mean, just consider all of the new media. Consider the ways in which we're learning about what was going on in the Arab Spring. Mm. And most of those images and most of those reports were coming not through traditional, conventional media outlets, but were coming via cell phone pictures. And so teaching students more of what they already know, being very savvy in new media technology, as we all know, adds a tremendous dimension of engagement and activism, but not perhaps in the old 60s sense of the word activism, but in terms of engagement and playing an active role.
We're speaking with Dr. Leonard Haas, Director of the Peace and Conflict Studies Program at the University of Utah, also with Dean Robert Newman. He is Dean of the College of Humanities at the U, and Dr. Michael Minch, Director of Peace and Justice Studies at Utah Valley University. We're talking about peace and the increasing interest in peace studies on Utah campuses. So if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. We need to take a break, but we'll be back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Today on the program, Peace, Love, and Understanding, we're talking about a place for peace studies at the University of Utah and Utah Valley University. And the question is, can we teach peace? My guests include Dr. Leonard Hawes. He's director of the Peace and Conflict Studies Program at the University of Utah. They are seeking to establish a major in peace and conflict studies there. Also with us, Robert Newman, professor of English and the dean of the College of Humanities. He founded the Peace and Conflict Studies Program at the U about 5 years ago. And Dr. Michael Minch, director of Peace and Justice Studies at Utah Valley University and an associate professor of philosophy there. If you have questions or comments, or would just like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Before the break, we had talked just very briefly about pacifism, and I'm guessing, in your peace studies program, your classes, the ultimate conflict of discussion is war. In a peacemaking curriculum, is war ever justified, or does it have a pacifist feel to it? Dr. Hawes.
Well, I'd like to respond, and I know Michael and Robert might as well. Pacifism is one of those enormously complex, large ideas that at one end people might assume is inactivity, doing nothing. And at the other extreme, pacifism looks like very intelligent strategic and tactical engagement. For example, nonviolent movements. It's possible to consider some of those tactics. Probably the one most familiar might be Gandhi, but certainly there are others. Dr. Martin Luther King is another well-known example of nonviolence that in many ways can be considered a pacifist approach to conflict. And so I'd invite our listeners to just consider that pacifism is not inactivity, disengagement, but that it involves a full array of very different, intelligently thought out, carefully enacted approaches to conflict as alternatives to war, which is its own complex. We have all manner of conflict and war, and where that bright line is between them may not be so bright any longer.
Hmm. Dean Newman, pacifism and its place in the peace studies curriculum.
Well, again, as Leonard and Michael both have pointed out, this is a complex and complicated subject, and I think often what we do is look at pacifism in a very one-dimensional point of view. I think ultimately the historical study of pacifism has a very, very important role in these kinds of programs to see how nuanced it is, to see the different kinds of applications and effects that it has had throughout history. And sometimes it stands in stark contrast with the sudden, quick move to military might. And sometimes it is an adjunct to those kinds of moves as well.
Dr. Minch, anything to add there?
Well, sure. We teach about different kinds of nonviolent resistance in our program, as well as different kinds of violent responses to certain problematics. And There are a lot of ways to respond to certain problems of violence. But one of the exciting things about our discipline right now is how much empirical research is validating through a lot of very sophisticated study and analysis how effective nonviolent resistance campaigns are in overcoming violence. And so whereas most human beings, of course, whether they're in peace studies or not, think that sometimes one might need to turn to violence, and we study those matters of the ethics of war and peace in our program. It's exciting to learn in new and analytical ways how effective nonviolence can be, especially when paired with a number of approaches to solving problems. So it's a very dynamic, very sophisticated, complicated, and an exciting field of study, and therefore exciting field of application out in the world by professionals.
Hmm. Again, we're speaking about peace studies and a growing interest from students and faculty here in Utah. My guest, Dr. Michael Mitch, who you just heard, Director of Peace and Justice Studies at Utah Valley University. Also with us, Dr. Robert Newman. He is Dean of the College of Humanities at the University of Utah, and Leonard Hawes, Director of the Peace and Conflict Studies Program at the U. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. If you've got questions or comments about the programs or about the role of diplomacy in the academic setting, 801-355-TALK is our number. Leonard Hawes, you mentioned earlier that religion plays a huge role in the history of conflict. I mean, basically, how do you approach religion in the academic context when you're talking about peace-building strategies and conflict resolution?
Well, certainly histories of religion and religious conflict, religious warfare is crucial. It's fundamental. We're fortunate in the University of Utah College of Humanities. One of the other programs that Dean Newman is responsible for bringing on board is a religious studies program. And I'm working very closely with Muriel Schmidt, who is the director of the religious studies program. And like Michael's program, it's about a year behind where peace and conflict studies is. So they have in place a minor, and they're in the process of putting together a major. And she and I are already in close relationship with one another, collaborating on which of her courses in religious studies that includes Jewish studies, histories of the Muslim world, religion and conflict historically as well as contemporaneously. And so we're in the process of cross-listing a number of her courses, the courses in her program with our program, exploring some possibilities for joint teaching. And because both of us are committed to the foundational importance of religion, as well as economics in the study of conflict. So we're very excited about that collaboration because it moves us forward in articulating two very strong programs.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the emerging peace studies in Utah, and Dr. Leonard Hawes is with us from the University of Utah, also Dean Robert Newman from the U, and Dr. Michael Mitch from Utah Valley University. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. And let's go to the phones. And Richard is with us from Salt Lake City. Richard, hi.
Yes, I'd like to bring light to the Middle East and what's going on there. And when some half of the people are nonviolent, and the other half is the government is cracking down on them. It's just an interesting study. I'd like to hear your comments on that.
You mean on the United States' role in the Middle East peace process, or?
Well, just to an observation, to observe how they're doing. The people are just taking, the masses are taking to the streets, and with nonviolence in mind, it's interesting.
Hmm. Richard, thanks for the call. Gentlemen, who wants to take that?
Well,
Dr. Minch.
It'll be interesting to see when we get to the other end of this a few years from now, how the nonviolent democratic movements in Tunisia and Egypt fared vis-a-vis the violence used in Libya and Syria. So it's an ongoing situation. It would be premature to make hard and fast judgments about it. But clearly what we know already from Tunisia and Egypt is that nonviolence can be a very, very powerful, as Leonard was saying, a movement for radical change, all to the good.
It be lasting? And I think that's, you know, we've seen some of the nonviolent movements start out calmly, orderly, and then they devolve into, you know, violent reactions by both those in the power structure and those who are protesting. Can peace really have a lasting foothold in a movement?
Well, that does happen. Sometimes movements begin nonviolently and then they degrade into some amount of violence. That happened, for example, during the First Intifada. But it doesn't always happen. It's not actually typical that that happens. More often, when movements begin nonviolently, they sustain their nonviolent dynamics through the end of the movement. So that's more typical. And to the question, can it be lasting? Indeed, it can. So there's a lot of research that show around the world, Leonard mentioned the obvious and very important case studies of the Gandhian movement and the civil rights movement in the United States. But there are nonviolent movements that have established durable, sustainable, peaceful regimes around the world. And I'm not saying that violence never works, and violence obviously works in terms of immediate goals. But to build, what the research shows is that to build sustainable, democratic, peaceful societies, those come about more often through nonviolent campaigns rather than through violent campaigns.
Dean Newman, you're nodding your head.
Well, I very much agree. And I really like to think that these programs are helping to train the next generation of leaders in our culture, in our society. And these are leaders that we want to be fully engaged, very broadly educated, and aware of complexity. And I think, as Michael has already said, for sustained, peaceful society, those are attributes that are quite necessary. Hmm. So education is key.
What kind of demand are you seeing at the University of Utah for a peace studies major? I mean, you've had a minor for a number of years, but
we have, and
for the major, what is
the demand? We're moving forward with the major simply because there's been so much demand out of the students that are in the minor, as well as from a number of other students across campus as well. The same thing is going on with this religious studies program, which now is a minor and is moving forward quickly to major status. We have a number of students that want to study environmental studies and environmental humanities, and as well as international studies with a focus on peace and conflict studies or religious studies or environmental studies. So these kind of broad-based interdisciplinary / global international kinds of programs very much are the programs of the future for higher education.
We only have a couple minutes left, but there has been a lot of certainly some conversation about the role of a college education. And we sort of touched on how a peace studies program should relate directly to employment or opportunities in that regard. What kind of skills do you hope your graduates from your programs will develop from a peace studies degree that can transfer to a workplace? And does it have to be international relations? Dr. Binch?
Well, most of our students are planning to work with non-governmental organizations. Some are planning to work for the State Department to become a diplomat and so on. But NGOs are an extraordinarily fast-growing part of the employment sector, not only in this country but around the world. NGOs spend $9 to $10 billion annually, and some of their staff and some of their budget sizes are greater than some of the smaller states in the world. And in an era where there is an increasing desire to limit the role of government and to think of government as inefficient, and allow private institutions to do as much as possible, it makes the work of NGOs all the more important. So we're educating students who will enter professions, who will, as Leonard said earlier, be involved because they've been interdisciplinarily trained in all kinds of ways in the world, from hydrologists to economists to mathematicians to negotiators. working with all kinds of organizations. There's a extraordinary market demand for this. So, so just at a very practical level, the creation of our programs is simply a response to the demand, not only we have from students who want to do this, but from the world that says it needs to be done.
I want to sneak in one more phone call. This is Kilo calling from Salt Lake City. Kilo, hi.
Hey, hi. This is Kilo Zamora from the Inclusion Center for Community and Justice. Hi, you guys. How you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Doing fine.
Good. Well, I've watched all of your work, and I appreciate it in this city. I felt like it's been important for our community to have these kind of academic programs, both at UVU and at the University of Utah. And I just wanted to comment that, you know, at the Inclusion Center, we're running these same kind of programs, but in a local way, you know, with children and community members. And we, too, are seeing this huge demand where we can't even handle all the requests to do conflict resolution and peace studies programs with our program. So on the one hand, you're seeing the demand at the universities, but I also just wanted to throw in that we're also seeing the demand in the local nonprofit arena, too.
Kilo, thanks very much for the call. And sadly, we're going to have to leave it there. Our time is up. Dr. Leonard Hawes, Director of the Peace and Conflict Studies Program at the University of Utah, thanks very much for your time today.
You're so welcome.
Dean Robert Newman, Professor of English and Dean of the College of Humanities at the U, thanks to you.
Thank you.
And Dr. Michael Minch, Director of Peace and Justice Studies at Utah Valley University, thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having us.
And I believe the State Board of Regents expected to consider the University of Utah's request to establish a peace studies major coming up in March.
That's right.
Great. Thank you so much for your time, gentlemen. I appreciate it. Coming up next, we're going to be talking about green building at a reasonable price, but first a break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Up to now, building a green home has been a luxury, something you can do if you have the money. But one Utah architect wanted to show that it could be affordable, and now he has a house to prove it. Joining me now to talk about his reasonably priced green building experiment is Jörg Rugemeier. He is an assistant professor in the College of Architecture and Planning at the University of Utah. And Professor Rugemeier, thanks. Thanks so much for your time today. Are you building or remodeling a home? How are you incorporating energy efficient and green building ideas into your project? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Professor, I understand you started planning the 125 house a few years ago. You broke ground this spring. You completed construction this fall. What got you thinking about building a home that was both energy efficient and still at market rates?
Well, first of all, the possibility to build an energy efficient house is something that shouldn't be expensive at all. And that has been proven many, many times in the country where I come from, in Germany. Very energy efficient homes there are approximately about 5% more expensive than a standard home. And when I came here, I thought that must be an opportunity, that must be a possibility to so I would be able to do that that kind of process here too. And it was a big challenge, because when I looked into the market, I figured out very quickly that anything that is green comes with extra cost, and actually pretty high extra cost. So what I basically did, I just took what I learned from my own country, designing energy efficient homes, passive homes, which run on very low technology, and applying an integrated design process, which means as the designer or architect, I incorporate the entire team that's involved in the construction process from the beginning on. And I was very happy to find actually Garbett Homes in the end, who was basically the only builder who was willing to do that. Everybody else was not, all the way down to the detail where many of them didn't want to let me be part on the during the construction process, which is very important because the quality that's required for such a building needs to be controlled on site.
Mm-hmm.
And through that combination of integrated design process, at the same time using standard construction methods, standard components that are available on the US market, we were basically able to build a what's supposed to be 90% efficient by energy modeling, 90% efficient home at market rate. So when I compare that building to a standard architect design building, residential building of the same size, we are about right now about $1 to $2 more expensive than the standard house. But on the other hand, the 1 to 5 house has been built at much higher quality.
You said that you essentially took some of the principles from your native land, Germany, and incorporated them here. Can you just briefly describe what some of those principles are? What are some of the things that you said, they're doing those in Germany, but we're not doing them here, and seeing if you could make it pencil out here?
Well, the biggest difference probably is that in Germany, the residential market is pretty much, I wouldn't say controlled, but there's many architects involved, whereas here it's completely controlled by general contractors, builders, and the building industry, and there's very few architects involved. What that points to already is that the most important strategy for a highly energy efficient building is a good design. A building needs to be designed to its very specific site, its location, and it needs to be designed to a passive solar strategy. And those are things that don't happen on the market here. Using that kind of process in a building, you are already much better than the standard building because your building is able to catch the winter sun, for example, to heat the building. You can build barriers against predominant wind directions. You can use natural occurrences on site, like wooded areas and so on, to protect the building, which is usually completely denied and neglected, because in this market, very often people just buy, for example, stock plans from the internet and put buildings on their sites, just like they fit, as they fit. But there's no thoughts on passive solar design. So that's the first step. The second step is basically three very simple things, which is a highly insulated envelope needs to be highly airtight. And then the third thing would be the solar design. And those three things together make buildings very high efficient. So when I designed the 1 to 5 house, when the energy modeling came in, we were actually 90% efficient right on. So this was not really necessarily designed to high energy efficiency, but it was designed to these passive strategies, and that made it work, basically.
We're speaking with Professor Jörg Rugemeier. He's an assistant, an assistant professor in the College of Architecture and Planning at the University of Utah. And we're talking about green building, his experiment to build a single-family home that is 90% efficient at market value. If you have questions or comments, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. So your home, the 125 house, is 2,400 square feet.
Mm-hmm.
Is it all above ground? Maybe you can describe visually what this house looks like since we're on the radio.
Well, part of the solar passive strategy is to make a building very compact. So it's basically, just imagine a box, three-story box, with the first story halfly buried underground. So we have basically a walkout basement, that's how it's called. And then two stories above. The two stories that are south-facing have very big south-facing windows. So that's our kind of tool to catch the sun, the winter sun. And that's one of the most amazing, best-working tools. So for example, on a day like today, up in Summit Park, there's actually sun out there today. About 10 o'clock, which is where we are at right now, all the heating systems shut down because the sun completely takes over heating the building. That heat stays in the building way until midnight in concrete floors. And then the remaining three elevations, they have much smaller openings. We still have windows even on the north side, but they are small. They are high efficient glazing and window components. And then the 2,400 square feet, they include basically three bedrooms, a single two and a half bathrooms, a kitchen, a living room, and a studio. So the actual living space is about 1,900 square foot. So it's kind of small compared to other buildings in the area, but because it's well designed, it's very functional. So all we basically have everything in there that we need. Mm. Even the garage is included in the building mass, which is important because when we park the cars in the garage at nighttime, that extra heat contributes to the heating of the building at nighttime. Other than if you would have a detached garage, that heat would just be gone.
Now, your family is living in the house. You decided to build in Park City at a 7,000-foot elevation. Did the elevation present any challenges, any design or construction challenges for you and your team?
They definitely did. We have about 6 months of snow, maybe even 7 months sometimes. The temperatures go down to 0 degrees at nighttime. And since we lived in Salt Lake City, we have already a pretty good comparison to the climate difference. So it's very harsh, very cold, which is also interesting because when we energy modeled the building, the same building down in the valley would perform much, much better because of the difference in temperatures and nighttime temperatures. But it's doable. The most important thing was to find, or the biggest challenge was to find a lot that would have sun even on the day tomorrow, the 21st of December. Mm. Most of the lots don't have sun. And as I said, the sun is important to heat the building.
Mm. We're speaking with Jörg Rugemer. He is assistant professor in the College of Architecture and Planning at the University of Utah. And we're talking about green building and his experimental project, 125 House, which was recently completed. If you'd like to join us, if you have questions or comments about green building, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. And let's go to the phones. And Mark is joining us from Salt Lake City. Mark, hi.
Hello.
Go right ahead.
Okay, so my question is, what is the cost for building a home in this area? Because I built a green home with a bunch of the features that your guest just described. It uses 33 decatherms of gas a year and 3,300 kilowatt hours of electricity, so it's fairly efficient. And I was just wondering how my cost came out relative to his cost or the costs that are projected for home.
So we're comparing your pocketbook. Mark, did you go over budget?
Is that I didn't make a budget.
You didn't make a budget. Okay. Well, let's find out from Professor Rugemer. Thanks very much for the call, Mark. So how much did it cost?
We have about $122 per square foot. But that it's important to know that those costs do not include the cost of the land, the impact fees, and the design fees, my own fees. The reason why I exclude those is simple because I want to compare this kind of building to other places, to other buildings in other places like Salt Lake. Cost of land is very different up there and down here. Mm. And also impact fees are different. So that's why I exclude those, but it's a simple exercise. Everybody who wants to compare can exclude those costs from their own costs.
And what's the average cost per square foot of a new home, excluding the land in the valley?
The comparable cost of a comparable standard building, which then would be 0% efficient, and with 0% efficient, I mean it's built to code, just to the IECC 2006 code, would be $117 per square foot. Mm. That's a custom-designed home. We need to be careful. We cannot really compare to a production building home, which
sure.
is not designed by an architect, but a comparable building designed by an architect would be $117, and we are at about $122.
Okay. Mark, thanks for the call. I want to sneak in one last call. Jason calling from Salt Lake City. Jason, hi.
Hi, hey, doctor.
I
met you on a plane once coming back to Salt Lake, and you were talking about your house up in Summit Park, I believe it was. And anyways, I was wondering, are there any tax incentives available these days for building green? How's that going?
Okay.
Well, there are tax incentives. We haven't worked on that yet. We just started the process, which will actually bring the cost down about $1 or $2 per square foot. it's very, I would say it's very intransparent right now. So it's a serious project to go through it. And again, we work on it. This will all be documented in the publications I do. So if you wait a couple of months, you will be able to read about it. But right now, that's all I can say about it.
And you will be living in the home. You're collecting data. You will be writing about the results of this experiment in the coming months. Professor Jörg Rugemer, assistant professor in the College of Architecture and Planning at the University of Utah. Thanks very much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
City Views is a production of KCPW News. Jesse Ellis is our technical director. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. Next time, a student in Alpine gets outed by school administrators. We're going to be looking at the legal and moral obligations surrounding student privacy, student safety, and a parent's right to know. So join us for that tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.